From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Good morning. I am John Hingsbergen, and this week another interesting conversation about world affairs. And we have with us one guest in the studio, Dr. Michael Cairo. Dr. Cairo is Associate Professor of Political Science, Program Director of International Affairs at Transylvania University. Michael has a PhD from the University of Virginia, teaches courses in politics of the Middle East, international politics, international law, and human rights. He's published numerous papers on Middle East issues and is the author of the 2012 book, The Gulf, The Bush Presidencies, and the Middle East. And we are pleased to welcome Michael Cairo. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate you having me on today.
Let's talk, before we really want to learn about ISIS, the political situation in Iraq, America's potential involvement or actual continued involvement in that part of the world. But first of all, your background and your interest as a political scientist, American citizen, the name Cairo is not a connection to the Middle East, although it's an appropriate name related to Middle Eastern topics.
Sure.
But why the interest in political science and international affairs?
Well, my interest in political science really began under the first Bush administration when I was taking courses as an undergrad, and the end of the Cold War was happening. And when I went to graduate school at the University of Virginia, my graduate dissertation focused on the first Bush administration and U.S. foreign policy at the end of the Cold War. And naturally, Iraq and the Persian Gulf crisis at that time was one chapter of the dissertation. And it kind of broadened as I, as George W. Bush, of course, was elected and also went into Iraq. I myself have never been to Iraq. I've done foreign policy analysis, mainly from the U.S. side and the U.S. approach to the Middle East overall.
Does a political scientist approach these issues similar to the ideal of journalism, where you approach it from a point of balance, looking at facts, weighing the facts, looking at both sides of the issues? Or do you approach it from a point of view of, I think this way politically,
no,
and therefore,
you're generally more hopefully more objective, looking at it from the point of view of, for example, foreign policy decision making or the ways in which leaders are looking at this. My approach has been to look at the worldviews of the presidents and the ways in which the president's decision making style has impacted the decisions we make in the Middle East, and that's what I did with the two Bushes. So there's generally a framework by which you're analyzing this. I certainly have opinions about certain issues on the Middle East and Iraq, but those opinions are sort of secondary to the analysis, I think, overall.
So help us out with ISIS and Iraq, and we certainly are learning an awful lot about it. All of the talk shows, all the news programs have talked about this very volatile situation. Mm-hmm. For those of us who just don't quite get all the connections, if you can bring it down to the third grade level in terms of what's going on there and why do we mm-hmm. care about it?
Well, first off, as you've alluded to, it is a very complicated situation. It is a situation that are filled with dilemmas and hard choices. And it's easy to simplify the situation, but I think we need to be cautious in doing that. Let me start with ISIS, or now ISIL, depending on what you've heard, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The Levant referring to the Eastern Mediterranean, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, the region. This is a group that is influenced by Wahhabism, which is an ultra-conservative form of Islam, primarily based in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. Primarily, Wahhabism aims to remove corruption from Islam. They're aimed against secular leaders. Osama bin Laden comes out of the Wahhabi tradition. ISIL itself has a very harsh interpretation of Islam, you might suggest. Violence has been directed, obviously, against other groups, particularly Shia.
Extreme violence. It sounds like more extreme than most anything we've ever heard.
Yeah, and this goes back to what was al-Qaeda in Iraq. And before that, a group led by al-Zarqawi, who I'm sure people are somewhat familiar with. He was based in Jordan initially, and his initial actions were aimed at the Jordanian monarchy, which he viewed as secular, and the secular regimes in the Middle East are viewed as corrupt by many of these groups. He wanted to overthrow that group. That monarchy, rather. Once we went into Iraq in 2003, he moved his operations to Iraq and aimed was part of the operation aimed at removing foreign influence, particularly American influence, from Iraq. This is the al-Qaeda in Iraq, of course, was associated with the beheading of Nick Berg in 2004. The contractor, 26-year-old, I believe, contractor. Who went to Iraq. This is a group that has, throughout 2006, 2007, used multiple suicide attacks, multiple kidnappings, and other kinds of violence, and was successful that we then engaged in the surge, as it was its official name, the New Way Forward, but the surge in 2007. Related to that violence, and what's perhaps really significant here, and a lot of people I think miss when we talk about the surge, is that the surge wasn't successful alone. It was coupled with what was called the Sunni Awakening. A lot of Sunni Muslims, and this is a Sunni group.
That's right. That was one of my next questions. Yeah. The connection, you call them Wahhabists.
This is a Sunni group. Hmm. And a lot of Sunni Muslims in 2007 saw this group as not only extreme, but violently extreme. And they, too, were reacting against their violence. And so you had the coupling of the American surge in military forces in 2007 with a more moderate Sunni rejection of what was al-Qaeda in Iraq.
The moderate Sunnis being al-Qaeda?
No. The moderate Sunni. The moderate Sunni being al-Qaeda those and some opposed to al-Qaeda and those opposed to ISIL.
But haven't even some of these groups denounced ISIL or ISIS for their violent tactics?
Absolutely. Right? There have been multiple denunciations by more moderate Sunni groups and Sunni themselves.
One more question.
Yeah,
define for me, what is Shia then? Shia and Sunni are two different sects
and
two different approaches?
Shia and Sunni are two different sects within Islam. The Shia is traditionally a minority sect, but in Iraq is actually a majority of the population. It's 60 to 65% of the population in Iraq. It's a majority in Iran as well. Qatar is another place, Bahrain, where you have a Shia population of sizable proportions. This split goes back into Islam, and so you've got Sunni and Shia sects. We oftentimes forget in the United States, we think all Islams are alike. And that is far from the case. Much like Christianity, there is a diversity within Islam and within the sects themselves.
Now, President or Premier or Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is
He's a Shia.
Okay.
He's a secular Shia. And he himself, of course, is problematic here and part of the problem. Nouri al-Maliki has been disinclined to take American advice. He was very involved in the Bush administration in encouraging our invasion, and he was, I don't want to say handpicked, but he was certainly a favorite of the Bush administration to take leadership. But he has, since December 2011, when we withdrew from Iraq, he has used patronage politics, violence. In December of 2013, there were protests in Ramadi, sit-ins basically, against his exclusion of Sunni participation in various aspects of the Iraqi regime and Iraqi society. And there was basically a crackdown against those protesters, which explains in part why some Sunni are not wholeheartedly supporting ISIL, but certainly see in ISIL a pushback against al-Maliki's government. He's arrested thousands of Sunni leaders without any kind of specific reason. He is, with the military, which is also part of the problem here, he removed Sunni commanders and replaced them with Shia loyalists. The problem here is that those Shia loyalists aren't necessarily as competent as the Sunni leaders who were in place beforehand. He has contributed to the sectarian divide that ISIL is now playing on, because as a Sunni group, they are using this to rally portions of the Sunni population against the Shia population in Iraq and inflame that sectarian violence.
And we talk sectarian violence and the sectarian divide. This is basically a religious-based confrontation?
Yes and no. It's religious. But there are secular groups involved, and it's also ethnic. Kurds in the north of Iraq are also Sunni, but they're Sunni Kurds versus Sunni Arabs. They don't speak Arabic, the Kurds. They speak Kurdish. And so you've got an ethno-religious, perhaps is a better way to put it, divide throughout Iraq. You've got a divide between the Shia that are more religious and those that are more secular. You've got a divide even with the insurgents. You've got ISIL, which clearly is an extreme religious group. But you also have the men of the army of Naqshbandiya, which is essentially a former Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein, loyalists, involved in the insurgency as well, and they're more secular than the ISIL.
We're going to dig into the background of this most recent war in Iraq. Perhaps we could talk a little about the first Bush presidency and our involvement in Iraq in that era, which is now 20-some years ago. And we're wondering if you have any questions or issues. What do you want to know about ISIS or ISIL and the current situation in Iraq? We have with us political scientist Dr. Michael Cairo from Transylvania University, and we are certainly welcoming your questions, comments, personal stories. If you've served in the military, maybe you have been to the Middle East and have some personal observations, or perhaps as a traveler interested in world affairs, send us a note to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter and send us 140 characters if you choose, at WEKUEST, or get on the line at 800-621-8890. It's Eastern Standard on WEKU. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsberg, and with Dr. Michael Cairo of Transylvania University. Michael is an associate professor of political science and the program director for international affairs at Transylvania. And he's written extensively on the Middle East, done a lot of research on the Middle East, and that includes a book, The Gulf, The Bush Presidencies, and the Middle East. We encourage you, invite you to make a comment, question for Dr. Cairo, even tell us a personal story by writing to us, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, the Twitter, at WEKUEST. I believe you need to follow us in order to send us a direct message, or call us at 800-621-8890. In 10 minutes or so, we'll be glad to bring listeners on the air by the phone at 800-621-8890. Now, Michael Cairo, your book. Let's go there and talk about the Bushes and Iraq. First President Bush definitely had an issue with Iraq. What was involved there?
Yeah, I think we need to go back just a little bit further to really understand the issues. In 1979, Saddam Hussein comes to power, and he was a secular Sunni, essentially. And Sunni are the minority, Sunni Arab. He was a minority leader. Saddam Hussein, of course, was rather brutal to his populations, including the Shia and the Kurds. And he used patronage as a means of enhancing the Sunni position in Iraq. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration essentially supported Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein was involved in a war with Iran and the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution. And so Saddam Hussein was, in essence, an ally in the 1980s. When George H.W. Bush comes into office, he tries to continue that alliance and, in fact, extended commercial relations, agricultural credits, things to try and bring Iraq into our alliance and be a better state, for lack of a better term, in the American view. And then, of course, Iraq invades Kuwait, and there's a lot behind that, and we can get into that if you want to, but I'll skip over that for now. But Iraq invades Kuwait, and George H.W. Bush embarks on a process to evict Iraq from Kuwait using an international coalition, going through the United Nations, using UN resolutions at the time, to evict Iraq from Kuwait. It's important to note that it was a coalition that involved Arab states, including the Syrians. At least the Syrians were nominally on board, in a sense. And at the end of that war, the Bush administration sets up essentially a containment policy of Iraq to try and prevent Iraq from getting weapons of mass destruction and to contain Saddam Hussein from attacking the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south.
It was at the end of that war, Hussein still an ally? Or
no.
I imagine not. When I think it through.
No. He wasn't an ally. In fact, he was a pariah. He was an outsider to most of the world.
Was there a consideration by the administration of removing him from office at that point?
Not direct American intervention to remove Saddam Hussein. In fact, at the end of that war, the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, made a conscious decision not to send American troops to Baghdad, fearing that it would cause the coalition that included Arab states to fall apart, fearing that it would create a great deal of backlash, and also fearing that it would create a major problem of instability in Iraq itself. Now, we did support the Kurds' attempt to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but the George H.W. Bush administration's perspective was one in which they argued that the people on the ground had to do it themselves. We would certainly supply air cover or other kinds of assistance, and we wouldn't be unhappy if Saddam Hussein was no longer in power. That didn't happen. And in the 1990s, the Clinton administration basically continues the containment policy using airstrikes against Baghdad and against Saddam Hussein when Saddam Hussein got out of line, for lack of a better term. We had inspection regimes going on with the issue of weapons of mass destruction that I assume most people are real familiar with. But for the George W. Bush administration and the George W. Bush advisors, this wasn't enough. In 1998, Republicans and of course, Clinton and Democrats in the end, and Clinton agreed to the Iraq Liberation Act, which was starting to suggest covert operations against Saddam Hussein and trying to move to remove him. But you also had a group known as the Project for the New American Century, which consisted of people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, most significantly, who were arguing for the removal of Saddam Hussein in 1998 and 1999.
Those viewpoints are hanging out there, and was that pretty much the situation when 9/11 occurred?
Yes, absolutely. The first National Security Council meeting of the George W. Bush administration was a meeting in which they discussed Iraq and the removal of Saddam Hussein. The problem...
This is prior to or after 9/11?
Prior to 9/11. Prior to 9/11. George W. Bush, as early as 1998, said that his father had made a mistake in Iraq when he had approval rating in the 90s. and that if he was ever in the same situation, if he had that kind of political capital, he would spend it. 9/11 provided that political capital. Now, to his credit, he didn't immediately go into Iraq. But very soon after 9/11 in 2002, they start building the case. This is the Axis of Evil speech. And as that case builds throughout the year, the administration is determined to remove Saddam Hussein, making arguments, of course, that he had weapons of mass destruction, which is doubtful. In hindsight, of course, but also making the argument that he was connected to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, which is false, just false.
To what extent, as a political scientist, Dr. Michael Cairo, do you see the American public accepting that argument, though, and allowing themselves to be convinced that Iraq did have a very tight and strong connection to 9/11? Was that not the perception entered into that war in 2003?
I think after 9/11, it was easy for the administration both to make such an argument and for the American public, which was on a heightened state of alert and fear for very good reasons, to accept this. And so there were a number of factors that allowed that argument to hold true. But what we need to understand is that Saddam Hussein represented the exact kind of government that Osama bin Laden hated, a secular, corrupt government not following, in his view, Islamic principles. In fact, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden had we're essentially enemies when you look at it that way.
Well, actually, this is a good place perhaps to draw a caller into the conversation. You talk about Islamic principles and the religious connections or motivations behind a lot of this. Tom is on the line. Are you still on the line there, Tom, traveling through the area?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you
for staying on the line. Go right ahead with your question for Michael Cairo. I think it's very appropriate at this point.
My question is this. We hear so much a distinction between Sunni and Shia. What is the religious difference? If you could give as much detail as possible, why do they disagree on their interpretation of Islam? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Tom, thank you so much.
All right. Well, it goes back to really the founding of Islam. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm a religious scholar, but I'll give you the brief view on this. Following Muhammad's death, there was a debate about who the proper caliph, the leader of Muslims, both religious and political, should be. And the initial split is over who should lead. But there are other issues as well. At the Battle of Karbala, the Yazid, essentially caliphate, massacres Hussein, Ali, and they're Shia. They're essentially the first Shia, and you have martyrdom. Year are the group that you will see in white shrouds, beating their chests to remember the martyrdom
and this,
of Hussein.
This death of Muhammad was when?
I want to say 687, but I think that's
687.
Wrong.
687.
Yeah.
1,200 years ago, 1,300
yeah,
years
and,
ago.
Yeah, and to get in terms of details on practices between Sunni and Shia, I'm going to have to say that I would have to have a religious scholar really to go into that more deeply.
Is one more orthodox and by the book, so to speak?
It's tough to say that because within Sunni and Shia, there are sects as well. And so to suggest that one group is more orthodox and the other is less orthodox, you might have Sunni or Shia pointing to the other side and saying that, just as we do within Christian sects. But I think it's difficult to just simply say one is more orthodox than the other.
So Tom, you've asked the most difficult question of the day so far.
Yeah, a question that I'm not as versed in my ability to answer, and so I apologize with that.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about ISIS and Iraq, or ISIL and Iraq, and why we should care, especially why should we in Kentucky care about this major situation many, many thousands of miles away. Your questions, your comments, your personal stories, if perhaps you've been to the Middle East, write to us at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a quick tweet if you can ask your question that way, at WEKUEST, or give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on the air at 800-621-8890. Dr. Michael Cairo, political scientist from Transylvania University, here answering our questions as best he can from within the perhaps the ones of the more recent few hundred years, perhaps.
Yeah, well,
mention the number one more time, 800-621-8890. Yes.
Yeah, and we need to remember that Sunni and Shia, it's easy for us to lump all Muslims together in a group. And the real point is that just as you have Baptist and Protestant and Episcopal and Catholic and all different Christian groups, you have this within the Muslim community.
Various
as well.
Sects within Judaism.
Yes,
a strong, very strong Orthodox to Reform, etc.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, in this current situation, we've caught up to the war in Iraq that the Bush administration launched in 2003. Obama came forward with a promise to end that war in his 2007 campaign or 2008 campaign. Uh-huh. He did,
right.
But it took 3 years to do so.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Is it over? Is it really over? Or is this current situation—
You mean is American intervention over, or is the civil war still going on?
That's a good way to define that question, because as I think about it, in the minds of a lot of us, yes, we were there. Yes, we came home. Did we ever really go home? Haven't we kept people over there? And now we're just going to send some more, quote, advisors in.
Yeah, we've got, we're sending 300 military advisors. I think the reality now is that— as I started the program, I said there are lots of dilemmas and lots of hard choices. President Obama doesn't face an easy answer here. But the reality is that I don't think either the American public or the administration is prepared to put boots on the ground at this point. I think the more likely military option, if there is one, is airstrikes. Yet, the administration has made clear that they want the new government in Iraq to be formed before they really discuss this. Now, there were elections in April. The parliament meets July the 1st. Nouri al-Maliki's party, the State of Law Party, won 92 of 328 seats, which means he needs to find a coalition to get 50% plus one in the parliament in order to maintain his position. Now, today we hear that the Syrians have issued strikes against rebels on the border between Iraq and Syria, and Nouri al-Maliki has welcomed that. There is an irony here in that in the wake of the United States not pursuing airstrikes at the moment, Syria is filling the gap, in essence, along the border against the insurgents.
And we are not allies with Syria.
No,
although this is
quickly becoming a very odd set of not really allies or even a coalition, but an odd set of players when you think about it. Iran is also involved in this crisis in assisting against the insurgents against ISIL. There are reports that Revolutionary Guard members are in Baghdad supporting and helping Nouri al-Maliki and the Shia here. Iran is likely to increase equipment and assistance to Iraq. Many people go back to the Syrian civil war, and it's Iran that bailed out Assad in many ways, and it looks like Iran might be the one to bail out Maliki in this situation. So you've got this odd sort of situation where the U.S. and Iran are quote-unquote on the same side with Syria at the moment, against the insurgents.
We talk about the reluctance to put boots on the ground, but the apparent comfort in moving forward with airstrikes. A lot of that would be with drones, I guess.
That would be my assumption, is that a lot of that would be drone operated.
And what's the objective there when they go in?
That's one of the problems. There have been talks that airstrikes could provide cover for an Iraqi army that really needs more training. As I noted before, Sunni leaders within the Iraqi army were replaced by Shia loyalists who have less competence. One-fifth of Iraqi equipment is missing. One-quarter of Iraqi units are missing. There are desertions by Sunni in some of these military units.
The missing equipment and weapons are in the hands of
They're missing. They could be in the hands of ISIL. It's not really clear. But it's clear that the Iraqi military is not particularly competent at the moment. And so training and advising is necessary. And I would guess that if we use airstrikes, that the airstrikes would mainly be at specific targets aimed at dismantling the insurgents so that the Iraqi army itself can then move in and deal with the problem.
We're about a minute away from another station break, but wasn't part of our purpose during and at the end of the war in Iraq to train Iraq's military?
Yes.
We didn't do a very good job.
I would say we didn't do a very good job, but this goes back to the Bush administration, which one of its first actions when it was on the ground in Iraq was to issue an order of de-Ba'athification, basically get rid of anyone involved with Saddam Hussein's government. So if you were in the army for a job, you were out. And maybe we can continue this.
Yes, let's continue this. And we do have callers waiting on the line whom we are definitely going to get involved in the conversation in the next segment of our program. It's Eastern Standard. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or get on the line, 800-621-8890 for Dr. Michael Cairo. We'll be right back. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsberg, and on this week's program, we are talking Iraq and ISIS, or sometimes known as ISIL, with Dr. Michael Cairo, political scientist, assistant or associate professor of political science at Transylvania University. And when we left off, we're going to get back to the phones in just a few moments here. Candace and Don, thank you for both being on the line. We have a number of emails we want to get to as well. We're grateful for those questions. We're going to try to answer those questions. Why do we care about Iraq and ISIL? And Dr. Cairo helping to sort this out, helping us to understand what's going on over there. My recent question was, did we do a bad job in the training and preparing Iraq's troops to take over when we got out?
We certainly weren't prepared for nation building. We thought it would be an easy war, or at least the Bush administration thought it would be an easy war, and then the Iraqis would take over. But part of the problem here is also Nouri al-Maliki. He is disinclined to accept American advice, and he was moving very quickly to get American troops out. December 2011, I think even the Obama administration thought might be too soon, as they were moving along on this, although politically it was important for the upcoming election. But Nouri al-Maliki, has in part, going back to things I said earlier, created some of these problems himself as well, with the things that he has done that have created the kind of incompetence within the army and Sunni desertions, and the army is being seen as sort of a tool of the Shia against the other groups in part as well.
It's not like we were incompetent or unable to train. All those complications behind the scenes, the will to actually access the training, to use it, and decisions about how to actually make use of the training.
I think the issue is that our military is very competent in terms of what it does, but our policymakers oftentimes muck it up. And if the policymakers don't give them the tools, and if you have a situation on the ground where you've got a leader who is disinclined to accept the advice, you have a sort of a confluence of things that are creating a problem and not just one thing.
Let's turn to our listeners on this week's Eastern Standard. Candace is on the line from Berea. Thank you for being patient and hanging in there with us, Candace. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I'm calling because one of the questions that you posed in the premise for this whole show was, you know, why should we care? As somebody who is really against the whole military-industrial complex to begin with, I do have to say that one of the reasons that we have to care is just because these people, they're humans. They're just like you and I. They've been through almost 2 decades, if not more, of direct turmoil because of war and conflict that has just been pervasive throughout the region. We really, you know, and because of the instability that we helped to create in this region, even despite the fact that Saddam Hussein was not necessarily the ideal leader, we have a responsibility to care about what happens in Iraq, because this is, it's before it becomes a military situation in our minds, it needs to be a humanitarian situation. And the people should not have to deal with these kind of military instability situations as a result of our action, our almost 2-decade-long action in that area.
So we care because we care about what goes on beyond our borders, because we are caring people, and they are people who deserve an opportunity to live their lives.
Yeah, thank you,
exactly.
Candace. I really appreciate what you're saying, because, you know, you've got 1.7 million internally displaced people. You've got a serious food problem in Iraq. The World Food Program is suggesting that this is beyond extreme crisis. 4 million Iraqis are food insecure. 1/3 of children in Iraq don't have access to safe water. And the caller's right. I mean, we do bear some responsibility there. Now, humanitarian aid is somewhat different than military aid. And a lot of this, of course, is being coordinated by the United Nations. And Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked for increased humanitarian aid. One of the problems with humanitarian aid is delivery. And we saw this, for example, in Somalia in 1993.
We can drop stuff in there, but it might not get to people.
It might not get to the people that need it. The UN itself may have problems delivering it because of who controls access to the various areas as well. Right now, the main refugee, internally displaced refugee camps are in the Kurdish regions, and we have access to those. And so that humanitarian aid seems to be flowing in, but it is a crisis beyond the proportions of understanding, I think, for us. Really.
Candace, thank you for your call. Let's take a look at an email from Jeff from Lexington. Jeff writes, I know that the Sunni awakening was a large component of the success of the surge in 2007. Were the Sunnis just practicing strategic patience and awaiting our departure?
I think some were. I don't think we could suggest that all Sunni were doing that, but I certainly think that those who were formerly associated with Saddam Hussein's regime certainly were patient and thinking strategically, and I certainly think that those associated with Al Qaeda in Iraq, now ISIL, were being patient. But that doesn't mean that everyone was being patient. There are Sunni and Shia on both sides calling for an end to sectarian violence and a more national unity, including the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani of the Shia faith.
Let's go to Don from Richmond. Don, thanks for calling 800-621-8890. You are on the air with Dr. Cairo.
Hi. I would appreciate Dr. Cairo's opinion on what you might call the end game. What do you think the ultimate possibilities are of a political solution? There have been discussions of partitioning Iraq and partitioning, you know, dividing the various warring sectors. But Sunni and, they've been fighting literally for 1,600 years. 1,400 years. They've been celebrating each year, as you mentioned, the martyrdom. These are very deep-seated hatreds. I just appreciate your opinion on what the ultimate results will be in this part of the world.
That is the most complicated question, perhaps more complicated than the earlier question. Certainly, one possibility is the breakup of Iraq. This has been a possibility since the fall of Saddam Hussein.
Iraq is a created nation anyway,
of course.
Right?
It was drawn with a ruler and a pencil. The Sykes-Picot Agreement, going back to the end of World War I. And so it is an artificial creation as a national entity. On the other hand, you have sort of already semi-autonomy with the Kurds. In essence, ISIL has some semi-autonomy in the regions that it is currently controlling. The end game here is a difficult one to see. I mean, we've got certain people like Ayad al-Alawi, a rival Shia secular leader to al-Maliki, calling for the national salvation government, which he called for and al-Maliki rejected. You've got Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shia cleric who has his own army, the Mahdi army, calling for an emergency government to deal with this. The problem for some of these is in the most recent election, as I said, al-Maliki got 92 seats out of 328. You know, al-Alawi got 23 seats out of 328. Al-Maliki is the closest to getting a coalition. So if you also have so if that coalition holds, you essentially are going the way of al-Maliki in this. You've got the Iranians who I think the Iranian interest is not to see an Iraq that's separated with Shia in the south and ISIL on its borders. An insurgent ISIL that it sees as threatening Shia.
Their preference regime would be to eliminate ISIL.
Absolutely,
and have an Iraq that's
and
more
to
moderate.
Have an Iraq under that's not, I wouldn't say more moderate, but an Iraq that's under al-Maliki that has closer interests to Iran, which. So, and it creates a whole other dilemma for the United States. You know, we've got, this is an opportunity perhaps to open up channels with Iran because we're essentially on the same side. But at the same time, by opening up channels with Iran, we increase Iranian power in the region, which continues the rivalry in many ways. So it's... I think the end game, and I think this is why the administration has been so reluctant in both Syria and Iraq to say, okay, we're going in there, because it's unclear what the end game would be. And I don't think anyone is entirely sure. But certainly the breakup of Iraq is a possibility.
All right, Don, thank you for your call. Let's go to an email from one of your colleagues at Transy, although she's an artist. This is Zoe, and she writes, I'd like to hear about how arms sales are, what the role of arms sales in this conflict. Is the U.S. selling arms to Maliki? His government has a close relationship with Iran. Who is selling arms to ISIS?
Thanks, Zoe, by the way, and I appreciate you calling in. In terms of arms, certainly one possibility with ISIS and ISIL is the Saudis, who were certainly supporting the insurgents in Syria as part of this. And Saudi Arabia, as I said earlier, has the Wahhabi connection. But the you should understand, though, that ISIL has a pretty good economy, so to speak. They have about $2 billion net worth. They picked up $500 million when they went into Mosul and took over the bank. They've been involved in
ransoms. This happened in the last week or so.
They've been involved in ransoms and smugglings. Another issue that becomes problematic here is drug trafficking that they have been linked to on some occasion. So you've got a mix of ways in which they're getting arms. In terms of the Iraqi government, certainly the United States has given arms to the Iraqi government. So too have the Iranians in assisting them. So again, this sort of weird semi-alliance, I guess, or the United States and Iran on the same side, which could, in the long run, if you see opening up to Iran as a benefit, and I think it would be more of a benefit to do so, could potentially be a positive in terms of U.S.-Iranian relations. Now, what that means for Iraq is a whole other mess.
And with no assurances that it won't turn to a negative.
Of course, but it's
against
the same.
Us for selling the very weapons that we sold to them, which has happened so many times before,
right,
coming
absolutely.
Back at us.
Absolutely. And in terms of opening up to Iran, you know, think of it in terms of Russia or China. We have relations with them, and yet they're rivals. Sometimes having the relation with them allows you to have more influence with them than simply cutting them off, in a sense. Yeah.
Mike from Richmond, really interested in your perspective here, Mike, as an Iraq veteran. So go right ahead. You're on the air with Michael Cairo.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say that I was in Iraq in 2011, and I got to experience a lot of things there, and I got to see what the Iraqi army was capable of in certain situations. And the feeling that I get, obviously I can't speak for all veterans, but the feeling that I've been getting from veterans who have watched Fallujah fall in the spring and the northern part of Iraq lately is that there's kind of a feeling that it's time for them to step up and take over ownership. But my question was, when I was there in 2011, I understand there were talks going on for keeping a nominal U.S. military force in Iraq to follow on after that security agreement. And I just want to know if Mr. Cairo has any information as to why those talks fell apart, if it was foot dragging on the part of the Obama administration, if it was more on the Iraq side of them just not wanting us there anymore.
Okay, well, thanks, Mike, and thank you for your service as well in Iraq. My understanding of that is that it was more al-Maliki. Al-Maliki had a close relationship with the George W. Bush administration and a close ear. He had less of a close ear to the Obama administration, and he was very disinclined to listen to the Obama administration. And I would place more of the fault on al-Maliki himself in the process of that.
Mike, let me ask you this, if you're still on the line. What's your perception of the political astuteness of our troops? You sound like you're pretty much aware of what's going on. When you were over there, were you and your comrades discussing politics and why you were there and what might be done back here and in Washington to get you back home?
From my sense of the group of guys that I was with, it was a lot of very well-educated, some of them that had taken time out of college to go on this deployment. And yes, we did discuss those things, but I think one of the main things that we realized that I, looking around what I saw and what kind of opened my eyes better than previously was the amount of waste, the amount of money, the amount of American tax dollars and the amount of American lives that seemed to have been, or especially the money that seemed to have been wasted over there. I recall specifically seeing a Department of State security vehicles that were about $150,000 up-armored BMWs, and we have been given information that those vehicles had been delivered 6 months earlier and hadn't been used since because the Department of State security personnel didn't like the way they drove. So, and that's just one example of things that I saw that really opened my eyes. But seeing the Iraqis and talking to them and the hope that they had for the future, coupled with the fear of our leaving, because I was there in December of 2011, and that really gave us a lot of pride in what we were doing, the hope that they had, but also, like I said, the fear also kind of gave us pause as to why we were leaving.
All right, Mike, thank you again. Thanks for your service. Thanks for being part of our show today. And Dr. Michael Cairo, Tom had written, "How might an established ISIS change the dynamics of the Middle East?" The bottom line end of our conversation question is, some have discussed maybe we shouldn't be over there, maybe we shouldn't get involved. Mm-hmm. We talk about sending advisors over right now. What are the consequences of no involvement and we just kind of sit back and watch it happen?
Well, of course, you've got consequences on multiple levels. You've got political consequences of an insurgent Islamic government that is radical and violent. In the center of the Middle East, you've got economic consequences. Already ISIS controls oil in eastern Syria and is selling it into northern Syria, which is selling it back to the Syrian government, ironically. So you've got economic consequences, and we've already seen, for example, that gas prices in Iraq itself have spiked because the Beji oil refinery that ISIL has been around and has been shut down mainly supplies about a third of Iraqi oil internally. And so that creates an economic crisis, which can spill over as well.
So. Michael Kairos, so many issues. We could use another few hours to discuss this. We're going to stay in communication with you. Thanks for making yourself available to be part
of
our conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate all the people who called in and those who listen.
Dr. Michael Kairos is an associate professor of political science at Transylvania University, the author of The Gulf, The Bush Presidencies, and The Middle East. I'm John Hingsberg, and thanks to Jonice Franklin at the controls, Julie Tennell on the phones. This is Eastern Standard. Join us again next week on 88.9 WEKU.